RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
We're welcoming back John Duffy, Chief Exec at Consumer NZ to RCR. This time, we are talking not supermarkets, we're talking banking. And we had a chat about this, I think, chat before last with John, as the Commerce Commission were, well, they were kind of getting ready back then to release a report on banking competition in New Zealand. That report has dropped. John, welcome back to RCR. What do you make of the report?
Look, it's pretty solid, to be honest. Recommendations are very practical. It's probably, in my opinion, the most robust market study the Commission's done to date. So those market study powers, you know, in terms of the how long the Commerce Commission's been around, are relatively recent. They've done 5 market studies now, and yeah, in my opinion, this one would be the tightest.
And what does it tell us?
Well, and it probably won't be a surprise to your listeners, it tells us that competition is not working well for consumers in the banking sector.
Right.
It tells us that there is what the Minister of Finance described as a cozy pillow fight going on for the bulk of the market, which is the big four Aussie-owned banks that make up around about 80% of the retail banking market. There's a fifth player, Kiwi Bank, which is struggling to have any real competitive impact because it's basically underpowered, it's undercapitalized. And then there's a range of smaller players which don't really have any impact on competition because they're not in the same league.
They've listed 14 recommendations. I don't know if you want to go through all of them, but maybe some that really come to mind that you think could make some sort of difference or could send a message to the monopoly, well, the pillow fighters, let's call them that.
Yeah, I thought it was a great quote from the Minister of Finance.
Not bad.
I kind of split the recommendations into 3 parts. There's recommendations in relation to Kiwi Bank and how you make Kiwi Bank match fit so it can actually provide some sort of competitive threat to the oligopoly. There is recommendations around enabling open banking to take root in New Zealand properly.
Can we just be reminded what open banking is again? I've heard of the term and I've had it explained to me ages ago, but a quick refresh might be a timely thing right now.
Yeah, it's an interesting term because it means lots of different things to lots of people. But at a really basic level, it means opening up data so that consumers, who are actually the owners of that data, can do more with it to open up access to new services and improve their lives.
You mean use any bank that you want to at any time without going through a whole lot of signing up and all of that, or have I got that wrong?
Well, it could get to that point. What it means is you've got imagine you're applying for a mortgage, right? And what happens now is you've got to print out 3 months worth of bank statements and take those in, and a mortgage broker will have a look through them and then you'll pitch those to different lending institutions and they'll go, yep, we'll lend to this person or we won't.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what open banking will allow you to do is to go, yes, I consent to this mortgage broker having access to the last 3 months of my bank transactions. That all happens electronically and instantaneously.
Okay, so you can just forget about that whole admin process. Bingo, done, moving on, using time better. Yeah, okay.
And people might go, well, how is that going to introduce competition into the market? Well, that's one use case that's commonly used to kind of explain the potential for open banking. But other great use cases are you're out for dinner with a group of people, you want to split the bill 5 ways. Instead of each one of you going up to the counter and paying a fifth of the bill, you jump onto a new fintech app that allows you just to already has access to your banking details. You just type in pay restaurant X amount and off you go. You all do that on the on your phones.
And, gotcha.
And on with the evolution of this type of stuff. So in jurisdictions where open banking's been around for a while, the UK is the best example. The use cases have really evolved. They've started at that quite basic level that I've just described. And now, you know, savings managers, apps that are almost like a bit of self-help, but they help you meet your savings goals,
right,
or provide, you know, immediate budgetary advice when you're considering things, investment advice, that sort of thing. So what we've had to date is, I think, as far back as when Chris Farfoy was the Minister of Consumer Affairs, so we're talking like 2020, he wrote to all the banks and said, hey, this will enable competition because it'll enable all of these little fintechs that'll offer much better service than big banks can offer to come into the market and offer kind of a slice of the service that a bank would offer. For example, the peer-to-peer out-for-dinner payment tool, right?
Yep, yep.
That's not a full bank service, but it's a business can get really good at that one little aspect of a service that a bank could provide, and they compete away at that. Chris Farfoy wrote to the banking sector and said, hey, we want you to enable this, and if you don't, we're going to regulate. And the banking sector went, yep, cool, we'll do it. And it's getting towards the end of 2024. We're still waiting for it. Okay. The Commerce Commission's now come out and said, this is a barrier to competition flourishing in New Zealand. It has to happen. And they set a goal date of mid-2026, which is still a long way away.
Right.
But what it's said to the banking sector is, get off your bums, stop dragging the chain on this, and implement this now. And so the banking sector's got to come up with a plan.
Okay. And they've got, what, a year and a half, 2 years to do that. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to mention there?
So the other two were enabling KiwiBank to actually have a fighting chance. So basically that means giving it more capital so it could has the,
yeah,
the capitalization to offer the kind of deals that you can get at the mainstream banks. And then the third aspect is kind of a warning shot across the bowels of the Reserve Bank to say, actually, some of your prudential requirements, some of the requirements that you even need to get into the game to act as a bank are too steep. And
that's interesting. Yep.
Yeah. They're basically favoring the status quo.
Yeah.
And it means new entrants can't get in, or even offshore banks that probably have the resources are turned off by the idea of having to, you know, have $30 million in capital set aside, not being used in case there's a GFC or something like that. Now, those are probably my least favorite recommendations because, you know, a lot of those Reserve Bank prudential requirements came about to protect consumers in case banks are trading recklessly, and we all know that happens, right? I mean, it was only this year that Silicon Valley Bank in the US went belly up because they were
over. In a matter of days?
Yes,
yeah.
That happens really quickly. And if you're invested in those institutions, you can take a bath, right? So it's important that there are protections in place for people. What the Commerce Commission said is, cool, we recognize that, but actually, Reserve Bank, you need to consider competition when you're making these rules.
Yeah, yeah.
And not get in the way of competition naturally occurring.
Because we can say, can't we, John, with certainty, that these big banks particularly have been making horrendous profits given the market size and the customer base size of New Zealand. They've been in the billions, right? I mean,
it's one of the most profitable retail banking sectors in the world.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, that's writ large across so many of the sectors that are essential to New Zealanders. I mean, we can sit here and have the same conversation about the supermarket sector.
Yeah, we did last week. Yeah.
And we could put the electricity generators under the same microscope.
Got a few questions on that for you too before you're gone.
Cool.
So you're impressed with the Commerce Commission report here. You think it's done a good job? I think I heard you say something like that.
I think it's a really robust analysis. And even the banking sector's come out and gone, it's pretty hard for us to argue with this. So, their PR people would have been sweating in the back rooms going, how are we going to spin this? And actually, there's nowhere to go on it because the findings are pretty solid. They've had to come out and go, all right, we recognize that, yeah, we've had it too good for too long. I think the CEO of ANZ, Antonia Watson, came out earlier in the week and said, yeah, of course we make profits. We have to make profits. We're businesses, and I think everybody accepts that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah.
And yeah, those profits are high because we have to attract investment to New Zealand. And I think there's a lot of people who have kind of squinted a wee bit at that and said, well, sure, but investment would still flow to New Zealand probably at half the level of profits that you're making. You don't need to make excessive profits.
Which is a considerable, even half the level, that's still a considerable cut. That's in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions less they'd be making in profit.
I think ANZ made something like $2 billion last year.
Wow. Okay. All right. I want to just quickly move on to electricity. We've had Shane Jones quite a few times talking about the Gen Tailors. We've had Harvey Week, energy specialist, telling us how we can get through these problems of low hydro and low peak capability. But it seems quite perverse that at the coldest time of the year, when people need their energy, it is the most expensive, given that a lot of the plant and machinery generating this was built and paid for by the taxpayer back in the day anyway. I know they're not substantially owned or majority owned that way anymore, but kind of feels like a social contract was broken somewhere along the way. And it's all about the money again. I might be oversimplifying that, but that's what people are feeling.
Yeah, I hear that sentiment. Absolutely. You know, the fact that we've got sawmills closing.
Jobs going in
areas that can ill afford that to happen, right? You know,
Oakuni.
Precisely. Yep. You know, that's the main employer in that town. That's devastating. And you know, we've got a government that is very conscious of the detrimental impact that insecurity of supply can have on the economy. So I'm sure there's people over. I'm right across the road from the Beehive, so I can see it out my window, but I'm sure there's people over there sweating right now trying to solve this problem. Yeah. So there's kind of, I guess there's three issues in your question. How did we get here? Like what's wrong with the market that in a country with supposedly abundant natural generation resources, we're struggling to produce enough power for our economy? Is the market structure the right? Does it have the right kind of incentives to generate power at a reasonable price for consumers and businesses, or you know, is it tilted in favour of the gen tailors? And you know, what steps should the government be taking now, or should the market be enabled to take to fix the problem? Starting with the last question first, I guess. Well, sorry, I'll start with the second question: are the market settings right?
Mm-hmm.
You often hear industry experts going, yep, this is how the market was designed, right? So this high electricity price is what's called a signal to generators that you can make significant profits and reinvest those profits in building generation assets with some security. And I get, if you read that in an economics textbook, you go, okay, cool, yep, you can make profits, reinvest them in generation, make further profits. That's growth, that's, you know, that's how it's meant to work.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that we have with the current market design is that signal is landing now, and it takes 10 years to commission, you know, decent grid scale generation, a little bit quicker for some other stuff, but it's 10 years. So what happens? There's a delta between that signal being received and the generation actually coming online. And what happens in that intervening period? Well, there's you know, monopoly profits are made throughout that period because there's a scarcity of supply. So to argue that the market is working well, and who pays for that? Sorry, consumers and small businesses. And
yep,
because the big businesses are, you know, have enough capital in the game to negotiate good contracts that actually we as consumers subsidize. So to argue that the market's working well and that's an appropriate outcome, I think is a flawed argument. In terms of what the government can do right now, well, they're looking at lots of different options. One of them's shipping in liquid natural gas from offshore. I think most people go, well, all right, that's a practical thing. But again, that's 2 years away.
You've got to build a terminal.
Yeah, you've got to build a terminal.
And that costs about $1 billion.
That's right. We're still focused on you know, that you're still burning fossil fuels when you burn gas, right? So in terms of emissions, that's problematic. But the reality
much rather
is,
have power, though, John. Much rather have power. I don't care about the emissions if we don't have power.
Well, that's right. The reality is, the way our system's set up, we need that firming generation that is generated by something that works when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing.
Correct.
And the lake levels are low.
Yeah.
The other thing we should note is we're having a one in, you know, I don't know, say 50-year dry spell. Well, this is the driest since it's been since the 90s. It's exceptionally bad timing. And we've had some issues. Well, we have a continuing issues with gas supply, irrespective of the previous government's ban on
On
gas exploration, which takes 10 to 15 years to come online. So the fact that they banned oil exploration 3 or 4 years ago would have no impact on what's happening today. It's a hot mess, to be completely honest. And
well, there was one thing that Harvey Week mentioned is that could be done within a year at the most, and that is add another coal-fired generator to Huntly and use that for peaking. That could be done quite quickly, but then you have to swallow the rat of coal, more coal.
Yep. And that's right. I mean, I think Shane Jones is pretty in favour of that. I've heard him yelling, more coal in the house.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And look, you're right, security of supply does trump all. There are other options that haven't been explored, which would involve campaigns through for energy use reduction
at a
consumer and industrial end, and also looking at moving load off peak times. So there are already energy retailers out there. When they can get a reasonable enough hedge, and most of them can't at the moment, there are energy retailers out there that are incentivizing you to turn the dishwasher on at 11 o'clock at night to you know, use up, because those hydro dams are actually generating the same amount of power all day long. So it makes a lot more sense for people to move to charge their EV or to do the washing.
At night. Yeah, where most people are off in beddy buys by then.
Precisely. Yep. So the more disciplined we can get as a populace to do that, actually there's some real benefits for that, because it flattens those peaks. It also means that some of the price increases that we've seen are coming about because lines companies need to invest, because we're trying to electrify our economy to dig ourselves out of our climate hole, right? Our infrastructure is not up to the task, so we need to invest in the infrastructure to upgrade it. Actually, we can slow that upgrade down if we move some of our usage off peak, a significant amount of our usage off peak. We still need to do those upgrades, but it can be over a 20-year time scale, not a 10-year time scale.
Well, that strikes me as not a difficult thing to do, really. It just requires information, education, and people to see the difference it makes to their bills, and also not to feel insecure that, you know, blackouts or brownouts could be on the way, because we've always perceived ourselves as a country with abundant energy. It's almost a bit of a psychological blow, you know?
Yeah, I hear that. We have some real problems with our electricity sector. So beyond dry years, electricity is expensive in this country. You know, 40,000 households were disconnected last year. 40,000.
Is that right?
Gosh,
all right.
And that is not a commonly known stat.
That's a small provincial city in this country.
Yeah, and that could be someone who's on a prepaid plan who doesn't have enough money to get through the next day, and so goes a day without power and then reconnects.
No, we can't have that.
Well, that's right, especially at this time of year. It doesn't bode well for us as a society we're putting up with that. And actually we're not talking about that. We're not talking about these serious energy hardship problems that are out there.
I remember being a kid, John, we used to have all heaters cranked on in every single room going all the way through the winter. No one gave it a thought. Jesus. There was plenty of power. and it was cheap as, and no one insulated because you didn't need to, you know, those were the days.
Well, arguably we had quite an inefficient but government-run energy sector at that stage. And, you know, let's not get into a takedown of neoliberalism here and the fourth Labor government, but, you know, under the Muldoon government, we built a whole power station that never ran, right? It got mothballed.
Yeah.
That is really, really inefficient.
Yeah.
But you're right, what you said at the top of the interview, taxpayers paid for a lot of the assets that we're still relying on as the backbone of power generation. A lot of that hydro, a lot of that gas-fired stuff was all built on the taxpayers' dollar.
For the taxpayers' benefit.
For the taxpayers' benefit, and that's what I think we don't see in the current market. We see, and you know, Bernard Hickey did a really interesting column on this the other day. If you compare the amount of dividends, every I think $4 and I'll try not to get this wrong, but there have been $4 of dividend for every dollar reinvested in infrastructure for the four gentailers, right?
Yeah.
Something's wrong when that's happening, in my mind.
Yeah. Really good chat. Thank you, John Duffy, Chief Exec, Consumer NZ. Always look forward to talking with you. Good to hear about what the Commerce Commission's been doing there on banking and talking electricity. I think there'll be a lot more. Well, there'll be talk about both, but people have got a real skin in the game when it comes to electricity. They really do.
Absolutely.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, Paul.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.